We're looking at the end of the story, in chapter 4, in these first five verses. We're just reading about procedure. Here we have Boaz going to the gate, and at the gate, this strange incident that happened with this nearer kinsman. In verse 1, that strange phrase, sit down here, is like handing a person a summons. It's legal terminology, and it means that you are called to appear in court. That's the meaning of that phrase. This incident happened just outside the gate of the city. It was a large area. We know from the scripture that on occasions they had conference with the enemy in the gate. And for obvious reasons, they would not let the enemy inside the city, so it was immediately outside in a large open area where people who didn't live in the city but wanted to come and trade and transact business would come into this area. And Boaz saw this next of kin coming. He apparently knew that he would be there, and as soon as he saw him, he said, "Ho, such a one." Why is it that his name is not given to us? It may simply be because the whole story was recorded generations later, and it might simply be that the writer did not know his name, but I think that is unlikely, because all the other personalities are given names, and there is placed significant meaning in their names. And that he wouldn't know the name of a nearer kinsman just doesn't seem right. It may be that what the writer was trying to do was to make it private, because it was a shameful thing that this man did, and in order to be courteous to the man, he would say nothing about who the man was. But that reason isn't really acceptable either, for the simple reason that what he did was shameful. It was always recorded that they did these things publicly in Israel for that very purpose of causing shame. And so for him to negate the shame doesn't really make sense. The third possible reason, and if you look down in verse 10, you'll get my reason for making a comment about it. The third reason is, the man died without a son. When he died without a son, his inheritance ceased. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I purchased to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren. In other words, if he died without seed, then his name would be forgotten in Israel. And apparently that is the reason why this man is called such a one. He is simply referred to as, "Hey, friend, passing by, come over here and sit down. There's some business that we have to take care of." And then in verse 2, "And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, 'Sit down here.' And they sat down." 10 is the number of governmental perfection. Numbers in scripture have significance, and 10 is the number of governmental perfection. You remember that there were 10 plagues that came to the land of Egypt. There were 10 commandments given by God. There are 10 kingdoms in the book of Revelation. It always signifies perfect government. And whenever Israel conducted business, it always required a quorum of 10 men present to be witnesses for that business. So he got the 10 men and he addressed the 10 men with the same wording, sit down here. We're going to perform some business. And then in verse 3, and he said unto the kinsman, Naomi, that is come again out of the country of Moab, selleth a parcel of land which is our brother Elimelech's. That he said that is fascinating. Notice though at this point that it was Naomi who was selling the land. I find that very fascinating and very interesting. Does she have the right to sell the land of her husband? The answer is yes. Although she is an old woman, she still has the potential womb for a child. And as long as there is possibility that a child could be born, that gives her the right to transact business on behalf of that child. That is the law of the land. And she is selling a field which can only be sold, you remember, we went over this before, until the Jubilee. Once the Jubilee came, all those contracts became null and void, and all properties previously taken over were restored to their rightful owner. So in verse 4 we read, and I thought to advertise thee, saying, buy it before the inhabitants and before the elders of my people. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But if thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me, that I may know, for there is none to redeem it beside thee, and I am after thee. And he said, I will redeem it. He advertised it. That doesn't mean the same thing as it means in our day. It doesn't mean that he put up posters over town advertising the fact that this piece of land was for sale or whatever. It was a colloquialism of the day, which literally in the Hebrew means he lifted his hair from his ear. That's what the Hebrew means. He lifted his hair from his ear. He uncovered his ear. It's the symbolism of picking the hair and moving it back from the ear and leaning over to the ear and saying into the ear, Naomi is selling a field. And I find that fascinating that he knew it and yet the nearer kinsman did not know it. And then in verse 5, then said Boaz, what day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. He's now adding a little piece of information. Catch this subtlety of this man Boaz. I think I know what he's thinking, because first of all he says there's a field and it's going up for sale and it belongs to Naomi, and the nearer kinsman would think to himself, Naomi, that's an old woman, and that old woman isn't going to have any children. If I can redeem the inheritance, then that will become mine. Once she dies, it will transfer to my ownership. And so he says, I will redeem it. Then Boaz says, oh, by the way, there's a little piece of added information that you need to know. And that is that at what day thou buyest the field at the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess. She also is an owner of the field. You see, she was married to the rightful heir of the inheritance, so that when her husband died, her child, should she have one, becomes rightful heir of that inheritance. And as long as she is alive and able to have a child, she becomes technically the potential owner of the field. Oh, says the kinsman in verse 6. I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I rear my own inheritance. Redeem thou my right to thyself, for I cannot redeem it. Now just think what's going on here. The man has said publicly before the 10 elders and all the other people interested in what's going on, when it comes to cost values, the kinsman redeemer said, I will redeem it. When he added the information that Ruth, the Moabitess, is also included, and he calls her a Moabitess, when he does that, he's saying, there's a little bit of a complication that goes with it. You need to be aware of the complication, because your responsibility as the kinsman redeemer is also to take Ruth and raise a seed so that that seed can receive the inheritance. And then in verse 7, now this was the manner in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing, for to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor, and this was a testimony in Israel. Very simply, what this is saying is when you do a contract, when we do a contract, we write up a contract, you put your signature on the bottom of it to legitimize that contract. That's what we do, isn't it? Well, they did technically the same thing, but they did it in different ways. If you go back, for example, into Genesis 15, you remember that Abraham is going to have a contract with God. And he took the animals and slew them, cut them in pieces, made two heaps of the pieces of the animals. What they did in his day, they took the sacrifice of animals, divided them into small portions, put them in two heaps, and the two men who were making the contract would walk between the pieces and they would verbalize their contract. And that was the same thing in that day as putting your signature on it. But on that occasion, Abraham waited for God to come, and God didn't come, and Abraham became tired of waiting, and he had to take a stick and chase away the birds that were trying to get to his sacrifices. And then a deep sleep fell upon him, and in his sleep a ball of fire came down from heaven, and when it did, it was the person of God, the other partner in the contract, and he went between the pieces, verbalized the contract, and burned up all the pieces so Abraham couldn't go through them. What God was doing, was giving an unconditional covenant. Now in the days of the judges, the days of Ruth in other words, what they did, they exchanged shoes. And he's explaining here that to confirm all things, a man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor, and this was a testimony in Israel. Well, why would the shoe not be a symbol? It might seem strange at first glance, but why would it not be a symbol? If you stop and think about this process, you've got to go back into their day. Remember that everything was symbolism to them. And in the symbolism of their day, what significance would a shoe have? Well, they would remember that when they were eating the Passover meal in Egypt, they had to have their shoes on their feet. When they went through the wilderness, at the end of the experience, they noted a number of significant facts about those 40 years, and one of the facts was their shoes never wore out. In Joshua chapter 1, verse 3, God saying in his covenant with Joshua, every place where the sole of your foot will tread, I will give it to you. You put your foot on it, stand your shoe on a piece of ground, and I will give you that piece of ground. In Psalm 60, God speaks when he's talking about Edom being his property, and he says, I threw my shoe over Edom. When the prodigal son came home, the father said, put shoes on his feet. In other words, I don't want him walking around here like one of the servants. I want him walking around like an owner of this property. And all that is significant when you stop and remember that when Moses saw the bush that burned and went to investigate it, God spoke from the bush and said to Moses, take the shoes off your feet. This is holy ground. Your shoes won't carry the significance here that they will carry anywhere else. This is my property, God was saying. Therefore, take your shoes off your feet. So what they did in this day, they looked at the shoe. It had all of that symbolic meaning to it. And so when a person took his shoe and put it on a piece of property, he meant by that, this is mine. On this occasion, when he relinquished his right to a piece of property, he took the shoe off. And you remember we read the last time of how a woman can go and complain to the elders of a city because the nearest kinsman is not willing to marry her. The elders would convene a meeting. They would call the person in question. They would bring charges against him. If he denied the charges, everything was correct. If he admitted the charges, then that woman would go over ceremoniously, take the shoe off his feet, and then spit in his face and pronounce a curse on him. That is the only way that they could get out of it. And this near kinsman, when you look at in verse 8, therefore the kinsman said unto Boaz, buy it for thee. So he drew off his shoe. He wanted to get the shoe off and exchanged as quickly as he could. Now all of that is very significant. Let me just bring up some questions we really ought to try and find answers to, if it's possible. I admit that we are really reading between the lines, but sometimes you can intelligently read between the lines. First of all, how is it that Boaz knew about the field for sale and the nearer kinsman did not know? Why is it that whenever Naomi sent Ruth on this mission, she sent Ruth to Boaz, who was not the nearer kinsman? Why is it that Naomi is selling the field? Between verse 4 and verse 6, where he says, I will redeem it, and then he said, I cannot redeem it, are there any conditions? There are. And those conditions involve the Moabites. And so we have to ask the question, when the nearer kinsman said, I cannot redeem it unless I mar my own inheritance, what exactly did he mean? Why is it that it would mar his inheritance and it would not mar the inheritance of Boaz? As far as we are concerned, you know that Ruth is a type of a believer. We know that Boaz is a type of Christ. Boaz wants to redeem Ruth. But there is somebody holding him back from doing it. Somebody has greater claim than he has. Who or what is that? Well, that is the law. That means that when the law on Mount Sinai was given, that law became a conditional covenant with Israel. I say conditional. Remember Exodus 12. They slew a lamb, and the lamb delivered them from death and bondage in Egypt. Then they came to Mount Sinai in Exodus 24, and this time a bullock was slain, which brought them into a covenant relationship with God. Then after that happened, in Leviticus 16, they slew a goat, and the goat brought an atonement for the sins of the people who had been brought into a covenant relationship with God. And then finally, in Numbers 19, they slew a red heifer, and the red heifer, sprinkled into water, brought continuous effect of the previous sacrifices. What happened in Exodus 24? Moses got the people together and he told them what God wanted in terms of contract. And the covenant was, this do and thou shalt live. And the people of Israel said, we will do it. So Moses then said, make a big clearing on the ground, and I want you to build an altar in the center of that clearing, and I want you to put 12 stones in a circle around that altar, representing the 12 tribes of Israel, and I want the tribes to gather together behind those various different stones. Then I want the young men to go out, and I want the young men to slay a bullock. I want them to get the blood and put it into two different basins. Then I'll take one basin and spread the blood across the altar. Then I'll take the other basin and with hyssop sprinkle the people that are making the covenant with God. Then he read the rules to them. When he read it to the people, they responded, we will obey it. And the answer given is, this do, and thou shalt live. In other words, for them to maintain a relationship with God, they had to obey the covenant that was given. They failed to obey it. The covenant was not of value for redemptive purposes. Its value was that it revealed the nature of the covenant on high, and it exposed the pathetic condition of man who wasn't able to keep it. And in those terms, it was the law that was the nearer kinsman that brought us to Christ. But it had first claim on us. It's a sad thing when you try to get people into the kingdom who want to come to Calvary before they've gone to Sinai. They want to get redemption before they experience condemnation. And Boaz is saying, there is a prior claim on this person before I can take the right of redemption. Let me ask you to look at another passage. It's in Galatians chapter 4. Here's the way Paul explains that. In Galatians chapter 4, verses 21 to 26, he says, tell me, ye that desire to be under the law, do ye not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondmaid, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, but he of the free woman was by promise. Which things are an allegory? For these are the two covenants, the one from the Mount Sinai, which gendereth to bondage, which is Agar. For this Agar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and answereth to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. But Jerusalem, which is above, is free, which is the mother of us all. And then if you go down to verse 30, you notice, if you read the record of Genesis 21, that Sarah found Ishmael mocking Isaac. I don't know what form that mocking took. I don't know if it was some kind of wording that was spoken or if there was anything more than that. And Paul said, when he referred to the fact in verse 29, that even so it is now. You get the people that are the children of the bondwoman. These are the people that try to please God by works. And they persecute the people of promise. The people that rely upon grace. It's never the people of grace that persecute the legalists. It's always the other way around. And it was so in the day of our Lord. And Paul makes reference to it in verse 30. Nevertheless, what saith the scripture? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. Cast her out. Evict her. Excommunicate her. Sarah called Abraham in and told him what she had seen and told him she wanted him to evict the mother and child. She wanted her excommunicated from the family. Basically, what she was saying was, Abraham, this house is governed either by promise or by the flesh. And it will not be governed by both. And Paul is bringing this argument up to those who receive Christ by faith and maintain salvation by works. And he's saying, that is wrong. So then, brethren, we are not the children of the bondwoman, but of the free. And therein lies the significance of what is happening outside the gate. Remember, outside the gate is outside the camp. That is where they had to take the goat and burn things. That answers to Calvary. And at Calvary, before the Lord would pay a redemptive price in a way we cannot understand, he turned to the nearer kinsman, the Lord. And he said, if you will redeem, redeem. The law said, I cannot. Then said the Lord, give me your shoe. I want you to lose all claims on my children. If I am going to redeem, my redemption is not going to be conditional that you've got a part to say in it, and I've got a part to say in it. I'm redeeming by grace. You have nothing to say. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6 we read, ye are not your own, for ye are bought with a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. In other words, they were to abstain from the sins which had been listed, not because Moses said it, Moses had no authority over you, but because grace says it. In other words, it is Calvary that becomes the focus of a Christian's ethics. And when you want to know how to behave and how to live as Christians, don't ask Moses, ask Christ. It always goes back to the purchased price of blood. And he's always trying to tell you that it's because you were purchased by the blood of the Lamb that you are not free to make independent decisions on how you will live. If you are bought as a slave, your new master is grace. and you must learn to become obedient to your new master, and you kick out the bondwoman and the son. And you do away with the law as regulatory, as you become regulated by grace, and the focus becomes Calvary, not Sinai. Now we're down to verse 9. And my time is almost gone. If you look at verse 9 in Ruth chapter 4, and Boaz said unto the elders and unto all the people, ye are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's of the land of Naomi, of the hand of Naomi. Notice that he automatically got all the fortunes of Chilion, Mahlon, and Elimelech. But notice especially he got Chilion's. Chilion's widow married in Moab, therefore she had no claims to anything in Israel. And so he says to the elders, I have bought everything. Then in verse 10, moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I purchased to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren, and from the gate of his place. Ye are witnesses this day. Now that's a brilliant speech, but we don't have time to go into it, but here is this bold, courageous Boaz standing outside the gate of Bethlehem, addressing 10 elders of the people and saying, I am holding all of you as witnesses to this one fact. I have this man's shoe. This man has no more claims on the inheritance of Naomi. And if you look at verse 11, and all the people that were in the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. The Lord make the woman that is come into thine house like Rachel and like Leah, which too did build the house of Israel, and do then worthily in Ephrata, and be famous in Bethlehem. And what they are saying is, may the offspring of this family rise to power and make Bethlehem famous. Was that prophecy fulfilled? As we come to the end, we have a genealogy. Is there any significance to that? Yes, Salmon begat Boaz. Salmon was the father who, according to Matthew 1, verse 5, married Rahab, the harlot. So when the nearer kinsman is afraid of the Moabitess, Boaz is not. His mother was a Canaanite woman who had lived as a harlot, and she is in the lineage of David. If you were to turn to Matthew 1, you would see that that lineage continued all the way through to Jesus, the Messiah. Well, I hope that's been helpful to you as a study in Ruth.